Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jobs, votes, Toyota trouble, and don't ask, don't tell in the news this week. Republican Scott Brown sworn in as U.S. Senator by Joe Biden yesterday, a 41st vote for the GOP, and goodbye to the Democrats, 60.
That you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you're about to enter. So help you God.
I do.
Congratulations, Senator.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Toyota President Akio Toyoda bows low in Japan and says he wants to resolve the company's problems as quickly as possible.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier and the dealers.
And Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen says it's time to toss, don't ask, don't tell.
Speaking for myself and myself only, it is my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation, Now What, in Washington, with Scott Brown sworn in and the president talking tough. Is the GOP ready to help govern? Are you still driving your Toyota? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ruth Marcus, columnist and editorial writer for The Washington Post. Ruth, it's great to have you back with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also from the Capitol, Doyle McManus, Washington columnist for The Los Angeles Times. Doyle, great to have you back as well.
Good to be with you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ruth, and Doyle.
We've got a lot of buttons on the checklist this week, a lot going on out there. But the kind of umbrella was President Obama talking in a sort of new way about politics and a very new vote count in the Senate. Here is the president from a town meeting on Wednesday sounding the theme of the week, saying only partisanship explains why Republicans are voting against things they used to support.
It's one thing to have an honest difference of opinion on something. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can't walk away from your responsibilities to confront the challenges facing the country because you don't think it's good short-term politics.
Don McManus, we've got a lot of issues to look at, but here's the president's theme over all of it this week. Does this look like a good fresh footing or not?
Well, it's a good fresh footing for the Democrats' campaign this year. It's hard to see how it's going to produce a whole lot of bipartisan legislation because it really is a campaign platform. I'm not faulting President Obama on that. The Republicans have drawn their lines in the sand. What he's really said is he's going to spend the rest of the year talking about the ways Republicans have gotten in the way of his agenda, which was originally a very popular agenda.
Ruth Marcus, we've got issues and problems and challenges just up and down here. Now Scott Brown is in. The president's saying, come on, let's work together. Don't just say no. Is this going to be the season of paralysis, Ruth?
Most probably. All election years are, to some extent, seasons of paralysis. I think that the president is playing the hand that he's been dealt and that arguably he helped deal himself reasonably well, which is to say, for every minority party, the Democrats, when they were out of power and out of control of one or both houses of Congress, for the Republicans now, it's something of a calculus between being portrayed as obstructionist and letting voters and risking that voters will punish you for that and the natural instinct that, and they are politicians, that politicians have not to want to let the majority party get the benefit of passing or whatever legislation can be passed or achieving it. So to the extent that the president can kind of mau-mau and embarrass Republicans into trying to find some common ground, that's probably his best strategy for this year.
Let's listen to the brand new senator whose election in Massachusetts changed the vote count so dramatically on Capitol Hill. Here's Scott Brown, sworn in yesterday at the Capitol. He spoke after on spending and deficits.
And there are a lot of votes pending that I would like to participate in. And even more importantly, there are urgent times for our nation. The president this week submitted a $3.8 trillion budget. And as you know, we'll have to borrow almost 40% of that because we don't have the money to pay for all the spending. And I am concerned that we're living beyond our means.
Jack Beatty, what do you see emerging here? Urgent times, a lot of people would agree on that. And there's Scott Brown, saying we're living beyond our means. Is it a paralysis formula?
Well, it looks that way, and the president is blaming congressional Republicans. He might as easily, it seems to me, look in his own party into his own strategy. Apparently a question raised with some vigor by Al Franken at a meeting last week with David Axelrod, that the White House really hasn't been, on health care, very effective in pushing it among Democrats. But the problem with the Republicans isn't just in the houses of Congress, it's in the Republican electorate. A poll this week commissioned by the Daily Coast, which certainly isn't Republican friendly, but by a legitimate polling organization, found that something like 60% of Republicans think President Obama is a socialist, that 39% versus 32% think he should be impeached. Now, that, as the president said last Friday, talking to the Republicans, he was blaming them again. He was saying, you've called me bad things, and your voters believe that I'm those things, and that makes it impossible for us to deal. And indeed, it does. If Republican-based Republican voters think he's a socialist, any dealing with Obama is politically perilous for Republicans, as even John McCain has discovered. He now has a primary opponent from his right.
Well, let's hear from some of them. President Obama was at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington yesterday, and civility, I don't know if that falls exactly in your bullseye here, Jack, but he was talking about civility, birthers and Muslim faith and Christianity. Let's listen.
Civility also requires relearning how to disagree without being disagreeable. Understanding, as President said, that civility is not a sign of weakness. Now, I am the first to confess I'm not always right. Michelle will testify to that. But surely you can question my policies without questioning my faith. Or, for that matter, my citizenship.
It's funny, and then it's not. It goes to real issues, though, not just faith and citizenship. The issue of jobs, very big. We've got this 9.7 number for unemployment out there now. That's as low as it's been since August. Democrats talking about, though, the need for more job creation. 8.4 million jobs lost in this Great Recession, going all the way back before Obama. Here's Senator John McCain at a press conference yesterday saying that the White House wasn't serious about deficit reduction, and he said the so-called jobs bill is evidence.
Now the president says he's going to have a spending freeze next year, and in the very next breath proposes $100 billion in new spending called a jobs bill. Not a stimulus bill, but a jobs bill. It's out of control.
Don McManus, what's coming on this jobs bill front? Do you see the Democrats standing up, holding together, putting together more spending to try and boost jobs, or not now?
Well, holding together is not a verb that describes the Democrats this year, and that, as Ruth said, has been a problem throughout. But yes, I think what you can say about the two parties right now is that the Democrats are trying to cast themselves as the party that is most concerned about jobs. As Speaker Nancy Pelosi says, their program this year is jobs, jobs, jobs. The Republicans are casting themselves as the party in tune with voters who are most concerned about the deficit, as Senator John McCain was just saying there. The problem is most voters are concerned about both things. And what President Obama is trying to do is give them a complicated two-step message. Let's take care of jobs first. Let's take care of deficits a year or two down the road. Mm. And the question is whether the voters in the middle are going to embrace that rather complex two-step.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was talking about the jobs agenda just yesterday and was asked by reporters, however, about whether Democrats were beginning to lose unity on that issue, health care and more.
We don't agree on everything, but we certainly agree on the fact that we're going to move forward on a jobs agenda. That's why we're here today. And the rest of the stuff is to what's all the disunity in the caucus is something you're imagining. It doesn't exist.
Ruth Marcus, the president's been saying to Democrats this week, come on, let's go. We've got to keep moving here, keep acting. Do you see the will, the votes?
I think there is a will that's powered by the most primal force in politics, which is the fear of not being reelected, to do something about jobs. And I just want to go back to the quote that you used from Senator McCain about not being serious about the deficit. And I have enormous respect for Senator McCain, and he has been serious about these issues. But I think that I am just so frustrated by the position of Senator McCain and some of his fellow Republicans who once were serious enough about deficit reduction that they were in support of the one route that at least I've concluded is the only way to get to serious deficit reduction, which is to have a bipartisan commission. The Conrad Gregg Commission is the way we shorthand it here.
And it was voted
down. All of a sudden, it was voted down, and it was voted down in part because a number of Republicans who once supported it and signed on to it, including Senator McCain, have now flipped and gone the other way. And the reality is that it's not that complicated. You have to keep both of these ideas in your mind at the same time. It's ridiculous to talk about immediate deficit reduction in the middle of a if it's not a recession, it's still a very slow and lagging recovery that could use the boost of extra spending, in particular spending geared towards jobs. And it's absolutely crucial in the long run to get the deficit and debt under control and to get the country on a sustainable fiscal path. And to use this for political purposes and to flip your views on that is just really, I'm going to use a harsh word here, unpatriotic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Toyota troubles, don't ask, don't tell. Scott Brown sworn in. Markets swoon. With Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times, Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a call right here from Holt, Michigan. Dana, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks. I just wanted to make a statement and then hear your response to
okay.
it. I am having a difficult time understanding how it is that a party, the Democratic Party, can lay so much blame at the feet of the Republican Party when the Democrats have such total control of power in Washington. They control the House, they control the Senate, up till yesterday had a supermajority, and also control the White House. How is it that the Republicans are obstructionists when they really don't have any power? I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
Dana, thanks very much. Doyle, I'll put it straight to you.
Well, the answer is that the Democrats got the worst of both worlds this year. Their 60-vote majority in the Senate looked like a supermajority, but Harry Reid never controlled those 60 votes. If you looked at the bazaar of negotiations that he had to go through to get to 60 on the health care bill in December, it was very clear that control is the wrong word. Even looking at it technically, two of the people in that 60-member caucus weren't actual Democrats at all, but because they had 60 votes, because they have a majority in the House, the country quite rightly looked at that and said, okay, go ahead and pass something if you're in control. The problem is there's a discipline gap between the two parties. The small Republican caucus in both the House and the Senate has been admirably disciplined from a political technician's point of view, has behaved like a parliamentary party and has effectively used its minority power to obstruct, and the Democrats have not acted as a disciplined, unified party in governing.
Let's go to Mike in Waverly, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I'd just like to comment further on what one of your guests said about Senator McCain and some of the Republicans who co-sponsored a bill but then voted against their own bill they co-sponsored. I think the president needs to keep focusing on their, you know, how they take one stance, but then all in the same breath, they vote against their own ideas, their own proposals. And I think he should, you know, maybe the DNC or maybe MoveOn.org should actually run ads in these senators' states who are making opposing votes as to what they say they support.
We'll look at that, Mike, and thanks for your call. Here's some interesting tape from Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. This was yesterday, talking about the federal deficit and how both parties helped build it. But he was holding it up as an example of how bipartisanship may not be a good idea.
You can't be this far in debt without both parties working together. That's the problem. We work together way too well in terms of indebting the future generations of the country. There is no way a democracy could achieve this level of indebtedness unless both folks were in on it.
Ruth Marcus, I want to come to you. Let me get Linda in Folly Beach, South Carolina first. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question basically is that these days I'm a Democrat. I voted for President Obama, and I'm still proud of it. Unlike my many friends and acquaintances who seem to have deserted this man, that they, I don't know, it seems to me people had these expectations that were just gigantic. No one is cutting him a break with everything that he inherited from the previous administration. And I just feel like I'm almost all by myself anymore in supporting the president. And in addition to that, I listen to a lot of talk radio, not the right wing, not the far right wing anyway, and I don't even hear a lot of what I would call well-balanced reporting on anything good that he's done or is trying to do.
Linda, we've got the point, and you've got another South Carolinian on a similar theme. Let me go to him, if I may, and thank you, Linda, for your call. Bob in Charleston. Bob, you're on the air.
Well, hi, guys. I just wanted to put my two cents in on what I perceive is going on. I just want to take my hat off to the absolute greatest political propaganda machine that's ever been put together in the history of the world. The Big Four, Hannity and O'Reilly and all those guys, they have done an admirable job of brainwashing the people. Mr. Murdoch, I salute him for putting these people together and making it happen. Obviously, you know, you have to accept, if you believe the GOP, you have to accept a proposition that a Harvard-educated person that overcame immense obstacles, was a virtual national unknown, had the color thing going against him, managed to get himself elected president, but he's not smart enough to walk and chew gum at the same time. And by an amazing coincidence, every single thing, and I mean every single thing he does, is wrong. Now, you know,
at least by their lights. Bob, we've got it. And Linda, before Ruth Marcus, what do you say to this pushback line coming out of South Carolina here? You know, is everybody walking away from the president? What's going on? Is it a creation of Fox and Roger Ailes?
Well, not just. I think Linda raised a very, very important point, which is that the president, to some extent right now, is a victim of the outsized expectations that were put on him and that, to some extent, he helped inflame during the campaign. He was never the Messiah, and he was never going to be able to usher in somehow magically a new era of bipartisan peace and harmony in Washington. Wasn't going to happen. People invested in him a lot of magical powers that, guess what, he turns out not to possess. He is not the sort of evil socialist monster of Rush Limbaugh and company's imagination, but he is, a from my point of view, very, very smart, very capable, as he's turning out to be, I think, actually really quite pragmatic chief executive. But the disappointment that is being experienced both on the left and the right is just over-imagining the Obama horror, and the left, I think, it invested him with way too much power to begin with, and so was inevitably going to be disappointed.
Doyle, you've been writing that the White House is watching this. They're hyper aware of what's going on, and they've got a new strategy. Gloves off. Describe it for us, Doyle.
Well, you heard a little bit of it in the clip you played of the president earlier, and that is that There's going to be some talk about bipartisanship here. The president keeps saying, he said it on health care again last night, that he wants to hold more meetings with his Republican opponents, get them in a room, and let's go ahead and debate the issues, as he did when he went up to Baltimore to talk to the Republican caucus up there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really using that as a cudgel, not as an opening, because the gap between the programs of these two parties is vast. And the problem until now has been a kind of asymmetrical warfare. Democrats, let's take health care. Democrats had spent the year coming forward with dozens of different plans, took all year long to settle on anything that looked like a single plan, and that left the field open to opponents, to Republican opponents, to criticize anything that came up. And in effect, as one Democrat told me, we had no specific plan to defend, but every criticism they made of a proposal was potentially valid. So what President Obama is basically saying now is, okay, let's take the spotlight off Democratic proposals for a minute. Let's put the spotlight on some of those Republican proposals, like Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, who held up a proposal that basically would have privatized Medicare for everyone 55 and under. Voters haven't looked at that yet. And so the calculation here is that if voters spent more time looking at what this very conservative Republican caucus is actually proposing, they'd turn against them, too.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? The big stick behind the Republican complaints is the very big deficit. And that has been used to great effect, been pointed to with great effect. On the other side, Paul Krugman, writing in the New York Times today, calls it deficit scare stories. He said the sudden outbreak of deficit hysteria brings back memories of the groupthink that took hold during the run-up to the Iraq War. On the third hand, if there's one, Jack, in Europe, I mean, we got stock markets swooning because in Europe they're worried about, you know, countries defaulting on sovereign debt. So, you know, debt's not playing out too well there at the moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, all sorts of signals there. The Economist magazine today speaks of the Obama budget as a roadmap to fiscal catastrophe, not anything the Obama is doing, but rather their economic forecast for the middle and long term. As Ruth said, that's where the problem is. And you know, it's not hard to imagine that with the troubles we're having, the irritations we're having back and forth with China, which holds our debt, and with what's happening in Europe now, it's not hard to imagine that at some point in the future, unless something is done about the structural deficit and debt, there could be a day of reckoning, a sort of a bond market revolt, if you will, against our currency, against our ability to pay, a worldwide crisis of faith in us. And of course, it wouldn't have to do with our economic capacity, as it does with Europeans. Some of these, Greece doesn't have the money to pay. Mm. We do, but what we have is a political default. We have a Republican Party that, for reasons of its constituents and for reasons of, as Ruth says, the primary motive is political survival. It seems willing to play chicken, even with deficit debt, it's very hard to imagine that the deficit and entitlement commission that the president wants to put together, it'll make its recommendations after the election next year. It's very hard to believe that, A, he's going to get any sort of Republican consensus in putting that commission together, and B, that when it comes down with its recommendations on Medicare, on taxes, that he's going to get much or any Republican support, which could be a terrifying signal to the bond market that we're just not going to deal with our problems.
Ruth Marcus, you've now got some, you know, on the right saying the deficit's already the problem, it's here and now. Look at the markets, the stock markets this week. On the other side, Paul Krugman still saying, you know, mm-hmm. this is the biggest slump since the 1930s, and the problem may be that we haven't spent enough to get out of it. Yes, there's a problem, but pay it off down the road. Don't panic now. Wrong answer, he says.
Well, I'm going to somewhat agree and somewhat disagree at my peril with a Nobel Prize-winning economist.
Oh, go for it.
And fellow columnist. But here's the situation. For one thing, to hear the Republican, I don't know if they're crocodile tears or what, but to hear the Republican hand-wringing about the state of deficits now and to blame the out-of-control, free-spending Obama administration for this is a little hard to take for people like me who were writing about the Bush tax cuts unpaid for and clearly in the face of surpluses that vanished, clearly piling up deficits, in the face of a prescription drug entitlement that was not paid for. I have a little bit of a hard time seeing the Republicans in their new self-assumed role as the party of fiscal responsibility. They were not for the last 8 years, at least enough of them. At the same time, I think that Paul Krugman, while he's right about the sort of deficit hysteria of the moment, and it is because the last thing you want to do is choke off a slow, faltering, nascent recovery too soon. I think that it is very clear that things could turn south extremely quickly for this country. Bond markets, anxious lenders, China, it is not a good situation. I agree with Jack's analysis of the risks of this commission, which will now be created by executive order. But I guess I've come to the sort of sad conclusion of compared to what, because it is hard to see another path to a potential solution, especially in this election year. So the opportunity cost, as the economists say, of at least trying this route, they'll come back in December with their recommendations, seems like better than sitting around and just wringing our hands.
Yep. Let's get our listeners in from Nashville. Carol. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I guess some of my concern goes back even farther than this. What in the world is the Democratic National Committee doing to provide leadership and punch in some of the recent races that have been lost? I get the impression that there was a sense of entitlement to Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts. And in the presidential election, Obama never even came to Tennessee because it was a foregone conclusion that Tennessee would vote Democratic. You know, so where is the leadership? And when they lost the seat in Massachusetts, I thought heads surely should roll. Where are the handlers for everybody to get candidates out there who are working the crowds and working the issues and really trying to be a little bit more bipartisan with all of this? I'll take comments off the air.
Carol, I appreciate your call, and we'll come right to it. The DNC question there. Let's get another from your backyard, Carol. Ed in Nashville. You're on the air, Ed. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Doc.
You're on.
Well, basically, the...
Sorry, Ed, you're breaking up on us. Keith in Rockport, Massachusetts. Keith, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say, while we're watching the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress go at each other all the time, with Republicans, you know, just being stalwarts, it's the populace who are suffering. And sooner or later, the people are going to have to do something to make a break in this. And, you know, I'll just take a comment off the air.
Keith, thanks for that. The people suffer while the fight goes on. One more, Jim in Montgomery, Alabama. Keith, thanks. Jim, hi.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a few comments to some previous comments that were made.
Our time is short before the break, Jim, so go to your most important, if you would.
All right. Regarding the tax breaks from the previous administration that weren't paid for, most people don't understand economics, that the tax breaks for corporations, that, number one, the rhetoric is that those would stimulate, they would take that extra money and it would stimulate growth in the corporations, hiring more people and so forth. There's a very simple reason why that does not take place, and that is there's nothing for those employees to do. There's only one way that prosperity for a company translates into prosperity to the general public, and that is and increased consumerism. And if you have more consumers, then, because otherwise companies, if they hire someone, there's nothing for those people to do. Most people don't understand that.
Jim, we're going to have to take it right there. The clock is moving on us, but yeah, everybody can feel that right now. Hire me. Hire me to do what? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hype everywhere this week, from space to Super Bowl to the Grammys. President Obama said he's inviting Republicans over this weekend for the Super Bowl. David Letterman had a field day.
President Obama is very shrewd about bringing the Republicans into the White House for the Super Bowl party, because he feels like if he can get them to pass the dip, maybe they'll pass health care. That's what he thinks.
NASA Administrator Charles Bolden, facing a reduced budget, said the future is private space travel. At a news conference, he lined up seven executives ready to take on the mission.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are the faces of the new frontier.
Yeah, and the big winner on Grammy night with a female artist record of six little statues, Beyoncé Knowles. We're looking at a week in the news. Toyota troubles, don't ask, don't tell, markets swooning. Ruth Marcus is here from the Washington Post, Doyle McManus from the LA Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Emily is calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Emily, you're on the air.
I'm calling about the current Toyota situation.
Yeah.
I have a 96 Toyota Camry, and I know that what's happening right now is really bad with the company, but, I mean, when it's time for me to come buy a new car, I still have faith that hopefully by that time that it comes around that they'll have fixed these problems and I can still trust Toyota to give me the same great car that I have now.
So your confidence not shaken yet. Are you driving it? What about this treasure, the Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood saying, you know, don't drive it?
I've got such an older model. It's about 12 years old. So I'm hoping that, I mean, these problems are coming up with their 2010 model. And I've never had any problems with it. It runs great. It's so low maintenance and such good gas mileage that I feel pretty safe in my car.
12 years old and feeling safe, and that's a kind of endorsement right there. Emily, thanks for your call. Let's listen to some of this back and forth, and I want to ask my panel today what's going on here. But here first is Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. This is Wednesday before the House Appropriations Committee, and here it came. His big line must have made a lot of Toyota dealers shudder.
My advice is, if anybody owns one of these vehicles, stop driving it, take it to the Toyota dealer, because they believe they have the fix for it.
Put it up on blocks. As soon as he came out of the chamber, he backpedaled.
What I said in there was obviously a misstatement. What I meant to say, what I thought I said was, if you own one of these cars, or if you're in doubt, take it to the dealer, and they're going to fix it. Okay? That good enough for everybody?
Is that good enough? And here, today, in Japan, the grandson of the founder, now Toyota president, Akio Toyoda, facing the media for the first time since the whole crisis unfolded, talking about his company's unfolding problems.
Believe me, Toyota's car is safety, but we are trying to increase our product better. So this kind of procedure is good for the customers. So please believe me, we always customer first is first priority.
And the president of Toyota bowing very, very low there. Doyle McManus, what have you made of this whole thing? Did Toyota go way out of bounds? Has somehow this blown up bigger than it should be, or not big enough?
Well, it's hard to say. It's blown up bigger than it should be when people have been killed in these accidents.
Yes.
And when you notice that reports of this kind of problem have been going in to the federal government, to the NHTSA, the Highway Traffic Safety Administration, since 2007, I think there is a lesson here about government regulation. Toyota spent a lot of time saying this couldn't be us, this couldn't be happening, it had to be driver fault, it had to be the floor mats, it had to be something else, in part because of Toyota's well-earned historical reputation for quality. It wasn't until an underfunded, understaffed government regulatory agency actually got on the case that this thing broke open.
Jack, a lot of Toyota owners are worried, and we've heard the tape of the poor family in California, you know, sort of driving at unstoppable speed to their deaths, and yet at the same time there's a kind of schadenfreude here. This is the same time American car companies could really use a boost, and they will no doubt get one from the trouble at Toyota dealerships.
They will, and don't we have a conflict of interest when, I'm sure, meaning well and being sincere, Ray LaHood speaks so breezily of what Toyota needs to do. I mean, after all, Ray LaHood is an agent of a entity, the United States government, that pretty much owns two of our car companies. I'm not saying there's an inherent conflict of interest, but there's at least the shadow of one in any comment an American official might make about the prospects of Toyota. Inevitable, given that we have, you know, bailed out the car companies, but there it is.
Ruth, it does get weird when the government's an owner of the American auto industry that's in the game here.
Exactly. Three quick points. I think there is an inherent conflict of interest, and while I don't think that's what motivated Secretary LaHood's comments, it underscores the sooner we get out of the car business, we as a government, the better off we'll be. Second of all, I think about Secretary LaHood, I think we can at least be thankful that he's not the Treasury Secretary, that he's only the Transportation Secretary, because God knows what could have happened to the markets if he had misspoken like that on the state of the dollar or something. And number three, Toyota, and I felt while one of the earlier callers was talking about her Toyota, I was thinking that maybe we were on Car Talk or something.
Right. It could be. And, it's right next door.
But well, maybe someday we'll make it to the big leagues.
Yeah.
But in any event, the Toyota having built up this reputation, it just shows how quickly it can be squandered. Mm. And the notion, it's just for me, I've never actually had a Toyota, but from the outside, denying that you have a problem, not jumping on a problem soon enough, pushing it off, it is a recipe for corporate disaster.
Here we've got Kathy. This is at the website saying, I love my Toyota. My last one went over 350,000 miles. I just bought a used RAV4 and have to say I'm still loyal. She says, every company makes mistakes. She says, it's like Obama. If you expect perfection, you're bound to be disappointed. Let's see what's going on out there. James in Nashville. James, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Driving in some rain here, rainy day. But I had a comment about kind of gays in the military.
Yeah.
And I'm straight myself and not in the military, but I do have several gay friends. And while I don't know any gays because they can't tell me if they were in the military, I do support their decision to serve our country and serve me. And so even if I don't support the two wars, you know, if someone is going to, you know, give that kind of support to their country, you know, we need to allow them to do that despite their sexual orientation.
James, thanks for your call, and we'll pick that up. Here's tape of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday, saying it's time to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Putting individuals in a position that every single day they wonder whether today is going to be the day, and devaluing them in that regard just is inconsistent with us as an institution. I have served with homosexuals since 1968. Senator McCain spoke to that in his statement. Everybody in the military has, and we understand that.
Admiral Mike Mullen, before Congress, Doyle McManus, how do you see this piece playing out in the politics of a midterm election year? Republicans have been very strong on supporting the military. Now, here's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying, time for a policy change, salute and go along or not?
And, you know, if you look at the polls, if you look at the voters, there really has been, over time, a change in American attitudes on this question. And what Admiral Mullen was saying, in a sense, is that that change has occurred in the military as well. It's very much generational. If you talk to younger officers, they don't care that much about it anymore. They just want to make sure they've got the most effective people in their unit. There will be some social conservatives who want to make this an issue this year, but it has been one of the things the Republican Party has done over the past year that has been effective in electoral terms is to downplay that part of its agenda and stick to its fiscal knitting. So I don't expect this to be a major issue in this fall's elections.
Mm. Jack, what do you see? This potent for opponents this year, potent for the GOP this year? It sure was trouble for Bill Clinton.
It was, but my, have times changed. There's Colin Powell, who led the drive against Bill Clinton in 1993-94. He came out and said, times have changed, and my view has changed with them. And I'm looking at the poll here. 58% of Republicans and conservatives say they support lifting the ban. So it doesn't. It sounds like, strangely enough, this is one of those rare occasions when there seems to be some consensus about making a major, not just symbolic change, but moral change in our military, and about time. 17 years after the Israelis, what, six or seven years after the Europeans, and as Admiral Mullen said, everybody in the military knows that they serve with homosexuals, and that the homosexuals serve with distinction.
Well, maybe a generation change solves the problem, and maybe not. We'll see soon enough. Doug in Dothan, Alabama, you're on the air, Doug.
Hi, Tom. A quick comment, and maybe it'll be worthy of some discussion from your panel. I've noticed over the last 12, 14 years, we've seen a flip-flopping in our progressive tax structure to more of a regressive tax structure, while at the same time, several choke points within our economy have caused the problems that we have. The housing bubble, the healthcare costs, the costs of pharmaceuticals, all of these things can pretty much be traced back to the massive amounts of money that the oligopolies that I just mentioned are pouring into Congress so that they can protect themselves only, rather than allowing themselves to be broken up so that we can have more small businesses, more innovation, and a growing economy. But yet nobody in the media, and certainly no one in either of these parties, is addressing this issue, which, you know, I just, in my personal opinion, if we tackle these things, then we solve many of the problems that we're all flitting around with the different issues trying to solve. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Doug, thanks very much for your call. Ruth Marcus, what about it? The Wall Street Journal reporting this week that Wall Street money now flooding in quite a volume into GOP coffers, hoping that Republicans will help them stop moves on the regulatory front. But Doug sees, you know, a bigger problem than that alone,
and
with money in politics.
Not just the regulatory front, by the way. The president, as he promised during the campaign, wants to let the Bush tax cuts on the wealthiest taxpayers expire and have the tax rates go back up to the crushing, and that's sarcastic and in air quotation marks for those who can't see me on the radio, to the crushing and economy slowing levels of the Clinton administration. And so, look, the point about a progressive tax system is very important. And in fact, President Obama would like to see the tax system made more progressive than it has been for the last 8 years after the Bush administration. And I think that is warranted under the circumstances that we're in. And I think, you know, if the caller is worried about the impact of corporate power on the political system recently, let him just stay tuned and see what corporations do with the new First Amendment freedoms that the Supreme Court has decreed that they have in terms of campaign spending.
Jack, speaking of economic structures, here's a comment from Kate on Facebook. She says, talking about the Chinese government dictating to the U.S. that Obama cannot meet with the Dalai Lama or sell weapons to Taiwan. She says the Chinese government is dangerous, and now they have the ability to destroy what's little left of our economy. The communists always said they would destroy America, but little did we know they could do it by using capitalism, says Kate. Jack.
Yeah, but Lenin actually, he complicated that. He said the capitalists will sell you enough rope by which you can strangle them. And, of course, we sold them the rope by going into debt and not paying for it ourselves. So the communists are getting their own back. Yeah, I understand what she means, but I am, you know, history doesn't repeat itself. It's the study of unique events. Nevertheless, there are some patterns that are troubling. One of them is the pattern, the comparison between what historians call the Anglo-German antagonism before World War I and the building folder, dossier of irritations between the U.S. and China. Germany a rising power, Britain a declining power, the U.S. a declining power, China a rising power, and then irritation after irritation in the pre-war era drove two countries that really had no reason to quarrel into a catastrophic war. And I'm not making any such prediction.
Well, are you talking half a century ago or a century ago now?
I'm talking a century ago.
Okay.
And where you had Germany, the Anglo-German antagonism, and we are building up that sort of thing today. And I certainly think Taiwan is an important ally and so on. But as somebody in foreign policy this week said, well, imagine what we'd think if the Chinese made a $6 billion arms sale to Cuba as part of some sort of – we wouldn't care for it. And I guess what I'm saying is we need to look at the Chinese, how the Chinese look at things in order to or else we'll keep going into these nationalistic – back and forth. And one of the problems, one of the things that made for the Anglo-German antagonism was nationalistic education in Germany especially. And, of course, in China, imagine dissenters just go to jail. There is no dissent. And in this country, yes, we do have freedom of speech and so on, but it's amazing how American writers and intellectuals see things the government's way. So, I think the Chinese are throwing their weight around. We've given them the weight, but I'm worried about the future and the pattern of things that seems to be evolving.
Doyle McManus, there may be little choice but to pay attention to the way China sees the world. American pragmatism may require it soon, right now.
Oh, it already does. China is the rising power in Asia. An immediate problem for the Obama administration is that China is digging in its heels and saying it won't go along with sanctions for Iran. So China is throwing its weight around, and it's going to be a big and enduring problem in American foreign policy.
Implications immediately, right now. Doyle McManus with the Los Angeles Times. It's always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today, Doyle.
Good to be with you.
And Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post. Wonderful to have you as well, Ruth. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. It's always fun.
Jack, have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.